From the National Urban League, this is For the Movement, a podcast that discusses persistent policy, social, and civil rights issues affecting communities of color. I'm Kim Atterbury, Senior Director of Communications and External Affairs.
And I'm Jordan Lawrence, Senior Manager of Communications.
This week, we have the pleasure of sitting down with activist, culture creator, and movement maker, DeRay McKesson, to learn more about him and to get his take on various topics in hopes of inspiring you to learn more about and join this movement.
But first, a message from our President and CEO, Mark H. Morial.
I'm Mark Morial, and this is your To Be Equal moment. Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2 of the United States Constitution directs the President, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, to appoint judges of the Supreme Court. It doesn't outline when or under what conditions the Senate may consent. It doesn't say how many days from an election or during the months ending and why or only when Venus is in retrograde. The framers of our Constitution expected the duly elected and sworn members of the United States Senate to exercise their best judgment regarding lifetime appointments to the nation's highest court, not to play partisan games or use it to score political points. That the Senate failed those expectations miserably when it came to the nomination of Merrick Garland in 2016 is hardly in dispute. The nomination will stand as one of the worst examples of dereliction of duty in the Senate's history, until possibly the one about to come before it right now. The President of the United States is under investigation by special counsel. His advisors have openly flouted the possibility of his pardoning himself. The question of whether a sitting president can be indicted is vigorously debated in public. The Supreme Court will decide these issues, and the president must not be permitted to choose the justice who may cast the deciding votes in his case. That's why the National Urban League is teamed with five other leading civil rights and social justice organizations to stop this constitutional failure from happening. You can help by calling 202-224-3121. That's 202-224-3121. And let your senator know that he should delay or she should delay the confirmation of any Supreme Court justice until the Mueller investigation is completed. Supreme Court nominations have long been seen and treated across the political spectrum as an opportunity for the president to advance his, or one day her, ideological agenda. Until Garland's nomination, this was accepted as a president's prerogative. Liberals are bound to oppose a conservative appointee's positions on the issues, and vice versa. This nomination is far different. The president has expressed a shocking and unprecedented demand that his appointees and those who serve in his administration pledge their loyalty to him and not to the nation. Leaders of his party in the Senate have adopted that fealty, partly out of political cowardice. There's almost no chance that a Supreme Court justice appointee by this president, confirmed by this Senate, can be expected to function as an independent check on presidential and congressional authority. Once again, I am urging you to call 202-224-3121 and urge the Senate to, one, delay this nomination, and also to vote no on this nomination, because too much hangs in the balance for you to remain silent. Please call today. I'm Mark Morial, and this has been your To Be Equal moment.
DeRay, thanks for joining us today.
It's good to be here.
So typically when we have guests on, it's to unpack a particular topic, but today the topic is you. So we're just going to throw questions at you and you answer as you see fit. Is that okay?
Boom.
Okay, let's begin. So who is DeRay and what inspires you?
DeRay.
DeRay.
You know, I started out as a teacher. I used to teach sixth grade math in East New York, Brooklyn. I loved it. Sixth graders are by far the absolute best. People teach high school confuse me. Like, I just, like, don't understand high school. But, like, sixth grade, I get. So I've always believed in the power of education. I did that. I trained and supported a third of all the new teachers in the city of Baltimore. I moved home. I opened up an after-school program on the West Side. So, like, kids, children through families was, like, my thing. When I was a teenager, I was an organizer. Mm-hmm. A youth organizer that focused primarily on bringing, like, young people and adults together to do solutions. I was working as a senior director of human capital in Minneapolis when Mike Brown got killed in St. Louis. I was sitting on my couch on the 16th, Mike got killed on the 9th. And I was like, the least I can do is, like, go for the weekend and, like, just see what's happening and, like, stand with people who are standing. And I got tear gassed the second night I was there. And I was like, this is wild. Like, this is something I've never seen before. And I'll do whatever I can to help out. And I remember at that moment in my career, I, like, made six figures. I had, like, a really senior job. And that was what I'd been raised to think of success as. Right. But, like, I wasn't any happier. You know, I could mm-hmm. buy sort of more things. And I wasn't, like, broke like I was, I don't know, 3 years before. But I wasn't, like, more fulfilled. And I remember being, like, I went to a good school. I, like, have a good career. Like, no matter what happens in the street, I'll, like, rebound one day. You know, like, I'll figure mm-hmm. it out in the end. So I felt like I could sacrifice whatever I could do. So I, like, you know, wiped out my savings account and my retirement account. All this, in hindsight, I'm like, what was I doing? It was the right decision, though. And I committed myself to this type of activism that I've been involved in the last 4 years. So I think about that. And then the last thing I'll say is that, you know, 4 years ago, I would have said that it was bad people making bad decisions in a bad system. I think now I understand how intentional all of this was mm-hmm. and that we could have, like, the best prosecutor and the best judge, but the rules are actually just not in our favor. So right. much more interested in the systemic change and, like, what that looks like at the root in a way that I just didn't know 4 years ago. Like, I had the language, but I didn't know what that actually meant 4 years ago.
What's the first thing you do each morning?
There are two news apps that I look at every morning mm-hmm. to, like, just peruse. So Twitter, obviously. Mm-hmm. I, like, open Twitter. I'm like, what's trending? What did I miss? And then I go through Flipboard, which is a great news app. And then there's, like, another news aggregator that I just check and just to make sure I, like, haven't missed everything. And then I read the Baltimore Sun. I've, like, been reading the Baltimore Sun since I was a kid. I read it online. It's like that's, like, my morning wake up. I roll over. I'm like, let me see what happened.
For those who may not be aware, DeRay is known for his signature blue vest. Why do you wear it and what does it represent?
It's funny. I never thought the vest would be, like, a thing for people. It's totally a thing for people. You know, people forget that in St. Louis, we were in the street for 400 days. People now look back at it like a really long weekend. But for us, it was, like, really long, 400 days. And so we were there for all four seasons. And I needed something that I could wear that I'd never have to pack. Because, like, we were on the street till, like, 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning. And wearing, like, a big bulky coat, like, running in that is just not it. So the vest was great because if it got too cold, I put a hoodie on under it. If it was, like, sort of just okay, I could wear it as is. The real question I think people ask is, like, why do you still wear it? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it for me has always been a reminder that, like, what we went through happened, that was real. Because I'm wearing, like, the same, this is, like, the same vest. I don't have, like, an affinity for vests, you know. I like, this one matters to me. And I can be, and you know, like, you can be in enough meetings and enough rooms and enough whatever that you, like, forget sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I never want to forget. So mm-hmm. I can go to the Vanity Fair party, or I'm at a White House meeting, or I'm meeting with a city council person in another city. And, like, I don't ever want to get in those rooms and, like, forget the energy that, like, created this space, or forget what it was like to get dragged out of a police department by my ankles or sit in a jail cell for 17 hours. Like, I don't want to forget any of those things. And I think sometimes we can get so far away from the things that created this space that we forget, and I never want to forget. So the vest to me is a reminder.
What is the most pressing issue facing this country?
I think that for people of color, it is what we sort of generally call issues of social justice, but more specifically, how we think about criminal justice and, like, what is a crime, who are criminals, like, that whole sort of panoply of issues, I think, is pressing for people of color. You know, 10 years ago, we knew mass incarceration was sort of an issue. We didn't know how we got here. Now we know, like, the how, right? We know that in places like Virginia up until this year, theft over $200 was a felony.
Right.
And Florida, theft over $300 is a felony. And both of those places, you become a felon, you permanently lose the right to vote. Like, we know we can, like, unearth and unpack those things. And we're like, well, yeah, of course that leads to mass incarceration, right? This isn't, like, a secret. So I'm interested in that, like the structural stuff that doesn't get as much sort of public airtime, but that is the stuff ruining people's lives. So you think about Louisiana and Oregon, the only two states that have non-unanimous juries. It only takes 10 or 12 people to convict you of a felony. Like that is, like that actually impacts way more people than some of the stuff that is getting like the most play in the public conversation. So how do we talk about those things? And with the police, you know, it's like 1 in 11 homicides in the state of California is committed by an officer. A third of all the people killed by a stranger in this country is killed by a police officer. So, like, that is wild. And, like, California has a – I'm just using California as an example because they're on my mind today. But California has a law that says that any investigation of an officer that lasts more than a year can never result in discipline. And, like, that is an example of, like, there's just two different systems of justice, right? That, like, there's one that you and I, if we commit a crime – the investigation can take 25 years and right. you're still going to get it, right?
Yep.
The police, and they manage the investigation process. You're like, that's just not fair, right? So how do we unearth those things to set people up so they can make a different set of choices?
Annually, the National Urban League produces a State of Black America report where we do a deep dive on how African Americans are faring against whites, Latinos, Asians. In your opinion, what is the state of Black America?
Yeah, I think the state of Black America is complicated, right? I think a part of it is really hopeful, and I think about hope as a belief that our tomorrows can be better than our todays. I think that what we've seen over the last 4 years with this wave of activism is that there's so many people, especially a generation of people, who are like, it doesn't have to be this way, and I'll fight like hell to make sure that it is not like this, not like this in the future. And I think that that is incredible. I think that the hard part is that the outcomes are relatively unchanged, right? So even when you think about the police, it's like the police killed as many people in 17 as they did in 13, 14, 15, or 16, right? So like even with this increased level of activism, like some of the outcomes around things that we track and measure and that you track and measure have like marginally moved, right?
Right.
The wealth gap, still a gap. The income gap, still very much a gap. We're making some inroads on like 5 for 15 and in some place around education, but like the outcomes are still pretty bad. The third thing I'd say is that, like, I want to believe that we're in a place where we have figured out how to imagine what we deserve and fight for it better. So when we think about wealth, right, so it's projected that the wealth gap is going to be the biggest gap in the history of the country that we've recorded in 2053, that the median wealth for Black people will be zero then. And you start to think about it, and it's like white people didn't like earn their wealth, right? They were just white. Like the government like gave them free education,
right.
Gave them housing loans, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and part of that is about like what is a government's obligation to us as people of color? And like we should start asking for all those big things. And you know, when I saw them rewrite the tax code on the back of scrap paper, it's like, you can't tell me none of this can happen. Like everything can happen quickly, right? Don't tell me that anything is impossible mm-hmm. if you did the biggest rewrite of the tax code literally on scrap paper in the middle of the night and people hadn't even read it.
Right,
you know,
right.
We can end mass incarceration. We could actually fully fund public, like we could actually do all of those things. Sometimes we have to remember that that's possible and sort of force the system to do them.
What singular issue do you wish people would pay more attention to?
I think I'm obsessed with like the structural part of mass incarceration because I think that it is so intentional that mm-hmm. like if you get people to realize how intentional that is and we break that down, I think that opens up space so people see how intentional all the other stuff is. That like, you know, we arrest more people for weed than all violent crimes combined. And when you start to like see how that actually functions, people are like, oh, I didn't know that. And you're like, you know, I was in a youth prison doing a talk not too long ago and like they were, I don't know, 15 to 17, 18. And they had this, I was telling them like, you know, the fact that whatever you did like was a crime, like somebody made that up. Like it was like God didn't like decree like these things are crimes and then there were laws.
Yeah.
Like somebody like made up that like this version of assault is a felony. Somebody
right.
made up that like you stealing that iPhone. Like this is all made up. And they were like, and you're like, yeah, somebody made this up, right? Like this is not a system of constants. This is not a system of chance. This is a system of choices. And like helping people realize that there are a set of choices that got us here and that we can actually be the people to make a different set of choices, I think is actually really empowering. I think that criminal justice for people of color, because so many of our lives like are touched by it, whether it is like our personal life or our family or our friends, like I believe that once we figure out how to talk about that and unearth it, that actually leads us to be able to do the same thing for education, for public housing, for transportation, for wealth. But yeah, like I'm always reminded that like somebody made this up, that this is not divine, right? Mm-hmm. That like all of this is man-made.
Who are you influenced by?
A lot of people. I think that when I think about the activism piece, you know, I think if I had not been in the street in St. Louis specifically, and I've been in most of the cities in protest, if I had not been in the street in St. Louis for as long as we were, I think I would never believe, I wouldn't believe as fervently in the power of like people to come together to just do something. I think that sometimes we confuse collective action for the work of organizations. And I think that what we saw in St. Louis was like collective action can happen whether you have a 501c3 or not, whether you know, like, the people coming together in and of itself is actually power. And like we were in the street for a long time, right? And like people would have told you that that was impossible and like you need a da 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 da. And like we didn't have any of that stuff and it worked. And so I like keep that spirit with me every day. I think that in terms of thinkers, it's like people like Rustin. I read a lot of Rustin. I've read everything he's published to just like think through the why behind some of the things they did, you know? Some influence by that. I think we're all influenced by like the beauty of Baldwin's writing. So like that is an easy one for people. And then people like Diane Nash, you know, like her determination and like discipline and training the Freedom Riders. Like I remember meeting her and like that was just like the way she talked about that training and stuff. I was like, I get it. Like I get the discipline. I like you came back night after night, even when it was hard, like those sort of things. I'm mindful that like we didn't discover injustice in August of 2014 and we didn't invent resistance, right? Like we exist on a legacy and those things inspire me.
In January 2016, you appeared on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, and you've been on his show several times, but this time in particular, you spoke really candidly with him about white privilege. Why is it important for us as people of color to have those hard conversations with white people, particularly those in positions of power?
I think that people don't... So, you know, I have a book coming out, and I did not write this in the book, and I was saying this to somebody yesterday, and I was like, we should write this down, is that this question of, like, and I would have asked him this if I was back on Colbert, is like, when was the last time that you didn't feel safe, right? Mm. And when you ask people that question, what's interesting is like white men say things like when they didn't have money, right? Mm. Or when they're like these things.
Yeah.
Women say things like you didn't feel safe in your body, like you didn't feel safe in your, like that is what, you know, as a gay black man, I know what it's like not to feel safe in my body, not to feel safe in my... But that is such an interesting way to think about like how privileged you are just in the world, right? Mm-hmm. That like the thought that like the only time you didn't feel safe is when you didn't have money is like so wild. That is crazy, you know? Yeah. Like that's like a... So I think that is like I've been fascinated with that like entrance into the conversation. I think normally we talk about privilege as like the way that you benefit from things that aren't a result of your hard work, but just sort of a result of the world constructed for you. And that's what I was talking to him about. You know, we switched seats in that and I didn't really know that was going to happen. So that was sort of like a, you know, just happened. And you're like, In the, you know, the sets of all the nightly shows are actually really cold. There's like this comedy theory that people don't laugh when they're warm, which I didn't know. So they're freezing. It's like you're like in an ice box and you're like trying not to shake because that would be weird. So you're like, hey, you're like, this is weird. So that was an interesting conversation. And I would go back to, you know, I would have asked him about the diversity in his writer's room. Like, I don't think then his writer's room was diverse. Right. And like, I just didn't know because like, why would I know about the Colbert Show writer room? But after I did that, I got messages from people be like, why didn't you? I'd be like, I didn't know. So yeah.
People often confuse activism with celebrity. How has the era of social media influencers and sort of a culture of going viral changed civil rights activism?
Yeah, I worry about it too. You know, I think about, you know, I had 800 followers when the protest started in St. Louis. So it was like real small. And and then you know, I have a lot now. But the interesting thing, because people have asked me this a lot, the interesting thing is that in St. Louis, whether I had 800 or 500,000, like my level of influence and impact was the same in St. Louis, right? So it wasn't until the first wave of protests ended that like, and some of us, I went back home to Baltimore, right? That it wasn't until I left that like specific place that I realized that people like were looking at us differently because it just didn't matter in St. Louis. You know, like I still could get 1,000 people to go to the mall. I still could, like it didn't matter. So being on the forefront of like being one of the early people who sort of like became a thing from the platform, I think that what I worry about now is that you see people who are engaged in the work solely so they can build a platform, not because they want to do good work, but because they want to build a platform. And like, I think that that is like a really damaging thing. And again, like, we didn't know. Only recently have I realized that there are people who like watch the live streams every night, or there are people like we just didn't know because like they weren't same thing in us. You know, they were like at their house in Nebraska watching us on the live streams. So I worry about that. I don't know what to do about it. I think that's one. The second is that, you know, the feedback on social media, I'm not convinced that we are designed to like get that much feedback that often. Like, that's just a lot to deal with. So Twitter is like a fundamentally different platform than it was 4 years ago. You know, like when we were in the street, there was only Vine. That was the only video on Twitter. So I remember like the way we did it is like we would take a video on like iPhone video. We upload it to Vine and we would literally stand on the side of the street after we took the video and we try and like listen to the best 6 seconds and then post it. Cause like that was all we had. I remember Jack, the CEO of Twitter, is a friend. I remember when he called me being like, Deray, we might buy this thing called Periscope. Can you test it? You know, like, and that feels like forever ago, you know? So there are so many people who like, they don't know a Twitter without Twitter video. It's like, we didn't have any of that stuff. You know, like we would have loved that. So it is different. It's like interesting to see how the platforms have just grown. You know, Instagram is like a thing now. Instagram was not it just wasn't a player in this sort of part of the world when we were dealing with the protests back then. So to your question about the celebrity piece, I do think people are doing it to be celebrities and not to do work. I also am always reminded that like for all the people who amplify messages now and who like, they're like, this is so great. A lot of them were not present before it was popular, right? That like, there were some people like Jesse Williams, J. Cole came down early. Like there was like a handful of people. But I would bet that like if it gets bad like that again, a lot of these people are still going to be sitting at home being like, oh, look at them. And so I never get confused about that. And like, I believe in that, you know, like we think about protests as telling the truth in public. And some people, the way that they tell the truth is online. And that's how they woke up, right? That they like saw a tweet and they were like, I didn't know. And like, that is really powerful. But I do think some people are in it for the performance.
What are your thoughts on the effectiveness of hashtag activism?
Yeah, I think that we've seen the power of hashtags to like fundamentally change conversations and like change the way conversations go, give people language. You think about everything from like Dapper Dan's resurgence, that was Twitter, to Me Too was Alyssa Milano's random tweet, you know, like to the March for Our Lives, that was Twitter, right? So I think we've seen that do really well. I think that the thing to remember is that like online activism doesn't replace offline activism. It supports it, right? That this is not about supplanting, it's about supporting. That we can create conversation quicker online than we can do offline. Like, it's just like the rapidity of the internet is just really powerful. That often needs to be reinforced offline.
So when Black Lives Matter was first established, there was a lot of chatter around Black Lives Matter versus legacy organizations.
Still is.
Well, yeah, still is, but maybe not as much. Is there a divide between Black Lives Matter, for instance, and legacy organizations like NAA or the Urban League? And if there is kind of like a generational gap, how do we address it?
So I'm reminded that the movement was not started by an organization, right? That like we came out in the street and like that was like, if not for the protests in Ferguson, there would be no protests all across the country. And the protests in Ferguson were not the inevitable result of like some organization's work. It was like people came outside and were like, this is wild. Mike should be alive, and like stayed outside. Right. And the police were so insane that like we just stayed out there. I do think that there's some people who literally can only think about collective action inside of organizations. Mm-hmm. That is like the only way they conceive of power. It's the only way they conceive of institutional memory is like inside of an organization. And there are other people who understand that like we can build power in many ways and like there doesn't have to be one way. So I think that that is like a philosophical divide in some ways. Mm-hmm. I think that there will always be a need for what we call legacy organizations to do that work that like, somebody has to go to those meetings. Somebody has to be like, that has to be somebody's job. I think that there will also need to be space for like a set of people who exist independently of those that like can push and fight and don't have to worry about like the money thing. Don't have to worry about paying people salary. Like they just can sort of do the pushing. And I think both are really necessary. I worry that people think that the inevitable conclusion of collective action is always like a 501c3. Like that worries me more than anything. So I don't necessarily know if it's a divide, like a clash between the organizations as much, or like the sort of like the the modes of organizing as much as it is like a philosophical debate. So that's one. And I do think that like some of the legacy organizations are like a little, are like not as progressive as young people are. So there's some legacy organizations that I will not name that I have never heard say anything about gay rights, right? And you're like, well, that's just not helpful. Or like, if you only believe that gay people are real people when it's like in the news or like a random Supreme Court case, and like that actually isn't helpful, right? Whereas there were queer people and Black women are like on the forefront of like putting their bodies online in the street. And like if they only become real and present in the middle of a crisis, like that's just not, like we struggle with that, right? I think that a lot of activists struggle with that. And then, you know, one of the things we saw early in the protest, and I think this has changed a little bit, is that there were people more interested in being our parents and our peers, right? So they call, they want you at the thing, but they really want you to like sit and smile and like say that they're doing a great job. And the moment that you're like, yeah, I don't know about this, they're like, why are you doing it? And you're like, okay, like that's not it, right? We are always reminded that it was none of the legacy organizations that like came down and provided infrastructure, right? And we would have loved them to, because we had no clue what we were doing. So there was one legacy organization that came down. They like protested in the middle of the day when it didn't matter. At night, when like craziness ensued, they were in their hotel rooms. And you're like, yo, that's not it, right? Like, we don't know what we're doing either, but we knew that we were under siege, silent, and we weren't going to do that anymore. So the least we could do was like speak out. And again, there are a lot of legacy organizations that only became proponents of this wave of activism when it became like socially acceptable, not when it was like it could have gone either way, you know?
So switching gears a bit, you mentioned, I think offline that you, or maybe you mentioned it earlier in this conversation, this recorded conversation, that you are writing a book. Tell us about that. And then also tell us what you're currently reading and what you're currently watching.
I know I need to, so the reading a little shaky because I've been writing for so long that I've been reading my own thing. I have a book that comes out on September 4th. It's called On the Other Side of Freedom. It is a set of essays sort of about the last 4 years and like where we go from here. It's the first time I've written about being gay and the first time I've written about my mother and So it uses, it's not a memoir, but it uses these personal stories to talk about like bigger truths. So it comes out on September 4th. You can buy it at deray.com. I like don't even know how to spell my name. DRAY.com. Watching Pose. I don't really watch a lot of TV, but Pose on FX, I'm watching that. Like, I'm doing a lot of train riding, so I'm like in, like, I'm probably on episode 3 of Pose.
I've heard it's phenomenal. I'm saving all the episodes so I can binge them all at once.
I've never even heard of it. What's it about?
It's on FX.
It's on, like, the ballroom culture.
Yeah.
And, like, the trans community and the gay community back in the day. Great. So, like, I just started that because I met, you know, because I met one of the actors at this thing and I didn't know, I had never seen the show. So I was like, what do you do? He's like, I'm an actor. I'm like, I'm what? It's like, yikes. You know, like, you're like,
that moment.
Probably should have, yeah. So I was like, the least I can do is watch it. So I'm doing that. What have I read recently? The most recent book, there's a young adult book called The Children of Blood and Bone, written by a young Black woman. She's like 20 something. Great. Like, absolutely incredible. Loved it. The only disappointing thing about the book is that it's a trilogy and only book one is written. So I'm like, what is happening to my people? Where are they? I need book two. But that was great. It just came, it came out recently. I got a galley copy, but it came out like in the past couple months and it's doing really well.
Well, what books do you recommend to aspiring activists?
I think there are a set of things that really influence me. I'm truly obsessed with Rustin's writings. Like, I think that Rustin is really interesting because it is really important content. It's not like Baldwin is so lyrical sometimes that you can miss the content for the lyricism, right? Rustin is like no lyricism, just content, and it just like works. You're like, okay, got it. So him, I was talking to somebody who's going to be a teacher for the first time, and I was telling him about Pedagogy of the Oppressed and Teaching to Transgress, the first by Paulo Freire and the second by bell hooks, both really important texts around like liberation in classrooms. I don't think that they, I know that they don't really write to K-12. Like, they're sort of writing about, I feel like their target is adult classrooms, but there are a lot of lessons that you can take from them that are like important and that changed the way I taught as a teacher. So I think about those. King is easy because it's King.
Right.
And the autobiography of Malcolm X is like remains, I think, like an interesting tool, especially when people see the arc of his life. I'm always interested in the way that people erase the end of the book, right? They like only go through sort of the beginning. You're like, what about the end? The end was sort of a whole different person. And even Rustin's writings on, and Baldwin's writings on Malcolm are so interesting, is that they I didn't realize that they critiqued him so much, you know, that they pushed and they were like, Malcolm, where's the plan? You ain't got a plan. You just out here talking. Like, that they actually have real critiques of Malcolm that I think we should, like, honestly engage. Mm.
Where can people go to learn more about you and the work that you do?
So at DeRay.com is, like, you can, we have a podcast that comes out every Tuesday, so you can get that there.
What's the podcast called?
Pod Save the People, which we love. So you can subscribe to the podcast at DeRay.com. You can order the book, those sort of things. And then me, Brittany, Sam, we launched Campaign Zero, which is a platform around, like, ending police violence. So we created the nation's first database of police union contracts and the first database of use of force policies around the country. And, like, we do a lot of data things to, like, help people think about the structural pieces of this. And then we do a lot of advocacy around the country supporting other activists. So in Florida, there's a felon reenfranchisement bill that's about to happen. And we are supporting and have been supporting those activists with, like, design and, like, strategy and reaching out to people and connecting people. So we do a lot of that stuff, but you can see it at joincampaignzero.org. Like, you can see most of that stuff.
We like to close out each episode by asking our guest what their call to action is for the movement, particularly in this political climate. So what is your call to action for the movement?
Yeah, I think that right now people, it's hard to fight for what you don't know. And my push is that people need to learn an issue really well, like, better than just, like, news news sound bites, but they need to, like, if you care about immigration, you should know immigration better than the random person. If you care about education, like, whatever it is, you should know well, because what you find is that the people who know one thing well are actually able to take that sort of knowledge and, like, extend it across a host of things. So I use my knowledge of education, like, I know education well, I use that, like, framework in so many other things, but it requires that I actually know one thing well. And I worry, because what I find is people who know, like, a little bit of a lot of things, and, like, they could, it's not like a, you can know just as much as me about mass incarceration. It's not like, I don't know, it's not like some secret sauce right. That I did. And I didn't take, like, some 400-level seminar. I, like, read and asked questions. And a lot of people can do that. And I think there are a lot of people who want to skip that step. They, like, want to go straight to the meeting with the whatever. And it's like, you don't know nothing. So when they ask you, like, what should the solution be? It's like, you don't even know what the problem really is. So, like, how could you be at the table talking about what the solution is when you don't actually have, like, any comprehensive understanding of the challenge? So I want people to be, like, closer to the issue that they say they care about and closer to the people impacted by that issue.
Thanks for joining us.
Boom.
Each week, we recognize an affiliate doing great work to advance the movement for civil rights and economic parity. This week, we're recognizing the Urban League of Rochester, New York, which is gearing up to help more than 300 people by providing job training, academic assistance, and other supportive services. The agency received $2.5 million from the U.S. Department of Labor to fund two re-entry programs for people who were previously incarcerated or otherwise involved in the justice system. One, called Project Steps to Success, will serve 125 young adults ages 18 to 24, and the other, called Project Beam, will assist 188 people over the age of 25. The programs will provide intensive counseling and technical training that can lead to industry-recognized credentials. The job training focuses on the construction industry, advanced manufacturing, healthcare, and food services because the Urban League and the Labor Department see growth opportunities in those areas. To learn more about these programs, please visit ulr.org. As always, you can follow us on all social media at NUL Policy for updates. Be sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, and Google Play. Kudos to our communications and policy teams here at the Washington Bureau and our editing team at Podfly. And thank you for listening to the National Urban League's For the Movement.